Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and I'm delighted to say we've reached episode 5 in our sojourn around the South American cities, where we now reach Cali in Colombia. So before we get into the detail and the education part, we'll come to the comedy part first with our two co-hosts. First of all, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, buddy. I would just like to stipulate that all comedy is unintentional, but also somewhat inevitable. So we're going to Cali today, and we've done a city in Cumbria already, but this is a fascinating one, and I know it's one close to Pete's heart as well, because it's where he used to live. So it's going to be a fascinating one, buddy.
Yeah, you should know a little bit about this one, because I've been disappointed with him so far in this series.
Rubbish, no, nothing.
Hopefully he might earn his money a little bit this week. But like you say, it should be another absolutely fascinating one.
Definitely, Mike, definitely. And we've been to cities where there's been 5 or 6 big clubs, and this is slightly different, where there's 2 major clubs in the city and the rivalry between them, and this can be a fascinating discussion.
Brilliant. And our next guest, just to keep up with that Hanna-Barbera theme from the Hair Bear Bunch, it's Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Definitely a bit of Herber going on at the minute. It's got that out of control. I can actually hide my headphones.
I didn't think you had me on.
It has. It's got to extreme situation now. It's critical point now.
It's reached critical mass.
It's reached critical volume is what it's reached. It's not the length now, it's the volume that's the problem.
Okay, so whatever's going to be the most craziest in this episode, then your hair or the football, I guess.
Well, you know, I think the two can match each other.
Excellent. Now, luckily for the listeners, we've got Pete back, so that's good for everyone who actually does want to learn something about football in this particular city. First of all, Pete, welcome. And I guess, like Gary mentioned, this is a place close to your heart and something that, like I say, you're going to know a fair bit about.
Yeah, well, hopefully. I mean, I'm also on the same hair front as Steve, really. I'm kind of channeling the kind of Colombian 1990 long hair, ponytails, you know, kind of probably flouncing about in the midfield somewhere. That's kind of what I'm going for. So I think we've got the aesthetic kind of down right for this podcast. Cali is obviously close to home. I moved out there in 1989. My dad was headmaster of British school out there. It wasn't a great time to go out, you know, like 3 days before. Some careless idiot had shot one of the main candidates for the presidency. So the whole country was up in arms and rioting and so on. And, you know, I mean, Colombia was one of the most dangerous countries to live in at the time, with all Pablo Escobar and the drug cartels. But, yeah, no, I mean, Cali holds a really fond place in my heart. It's where it all started for me in terms of my Spanish, you know, and, you know, indirectly, one or another, you know, ended up with me doing a PhD in Colombian football and, yeah, getting involved with you lot. So, yeah, it's all been a happy path of coincidences.
That's excellent. Hopefully this is a good part as well, and not a consequence, but is a positive. Just before we get into it, your love of football, and before, did you have your love of football before you went out, or did this really cement your love of the game?
No, I was already a fan. I mean, I think I'm trying to remember my first that yeah I'm trying to remember the, what the year was, but my first game was Southampton versus Leicester, who are actually currently playing in the FA Cup semi-final, which is a lovely bit of circularity. But yeah, Saints won 3-1 that day. Peter Shilton was in goal. So yeah, I was already a Southampton fan. I was already aware of football. I'd been to the Dell a few times. Was mad keen on all things football, cricket, everything else. So yeah, as soon as I went out to Colombia, that was really my way in to make friends. I didn't really speak Spanish at all. So it was really only through showing I could kick a football around and, you know, if needs be, kick a few legs of opposing players as well, that that helped me get involved and feel a part of a new group of friends in a completely different country. So, yeah, no, football was a really important point of entry. And, it, you know, I think, you know, elsewhere I've talked about this, but, you know, one of the most amazing things when I first went out was how you would see games of football everywhere, including in, you know, you'd have these kind of dual carriageways going through the city, and there'd be some kind of a bit of ground in between the kind of four lanes of traffic, and there'd be a few boys kicking around the football there as well. So it was everywhere. It was something that the whole country was mad on. Cali particularly is a city that is incredibly passionate about football. It's known as the Colombian capital of sport for a reason. And yeah, it was something I kind of attuned into, and you know, I was lucky enough to support the better of the two teams in this particular city fairly early on.
I've got to be fair. We should have done a bonus episode here on Pete Watson's school days, because it is really interesting. It must have been fascinating as a 12-year-old, sort of. I mean, I moved from Scarborough to Hull, which is about 40 miles, when I was 15, and I thought that was a big thing. But anyway, we'll save that if we do a bonus episode. But it is really interesting. So, Callie, then, you know, you mentioned the two clubs. You know, I suppose we should talk about what people are here to listen to. The two, you know, the clubs in Callie, then, you know, we start off, you know, every episode, you know, what are the major clubs, and sometimes the minor clubs as well, because sometimes they have a part to play in the city as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, Callie really is famous for two big clubs, the two historic clubs. We've got América de Cali, the red side of the city. That's the team that I was drawn to, slightly glory hunting, because they were a particularly successful team in the late 80s. The other team is the green half of the city, Deportivo Cali. Again, a team with a lot of history behind them. There are some other teams. It's worth kind of mentioning one that have recently reformed, actually, and that's Boca Juniors, a team that were a particularly strong side in the El Dorado Professional League. They weren't one of the original sides, Boca Juniors. They first joined the league in 1949, a year after it started. But they very quickly became one of the most successful sides of that early professional era. Sadly, they were one of the clubs that really suffered economically, financially, after the Pact of Lima led to all the foreign players really leaving Colombia, going back to their host clubs and elsewhere. And, you know, Boca Juniors, one of the teams that left the league and didn't return until only a couple of years ago. So they're back in the Liga B, the second division. Haven't had a particularly strong season this year, but it's good to see a team that has such historic roots back in, you know, professional football, such as it is. There is, and again, we talked a little bit about in the Bogota episode about clubs that have come and gone a little bit. There is one other club, which is Atlético Cali. They've had a few iterations previously. They were first known as Depor FC. They were Depor Jamundí. Jamundí is a kind of a little, really it's part of Cali on the outskirts of the town. It was, you know, it's kind of one of those clubs that changed, kind of lost its you know, it kind of offered its kind of coupon in the league a little bit. But it's still there. They've actually had a fairly decent year in the B League. And they're one of the teams that have quite an interesting, I suppose, rationale behind them, in that they seem to be making a bit of an effort to be a club that really advertises football for peace and developmental pedagogy. You know, they've got a section of their website talking about how football is a mechanism of social integration, and make a specific case to say that they are looking to give a route out of poverty and, you know, crime and gang violence to, you know, some of the susceptible youth in Cali. So Atletico Cali are quite an interesting club. How long they'll be able to carry on with that, who knows? You know, the changing nature of the clubs in the League B is always a point of contention. But really, I think probably this episode, you know, the majority of what we're going to be talking about will be Deportivo Cali and América.
Wonderful. Well done, Pete. Great start. Excellent. Thank you. Gary, you know, coming to you, I guess, for us, we probably feel like maybe we're on a bit more familiar territory. Two big clubs, big rivalries. You know, we've talked about this a little bit before. Cities that maybe have one club, whereas, you know, some cities, certainly in the UK, have to, you know, we look at Liverpool, Everton, you know, for example. And this feels like we're on a bit more I guess, ground that we can maybe relate to in terms of a footballing city.
Yeah, you're right, Matty. As you said, about two clubs in Manchester, two clubs in Liverpool, Sheffield, I suppose, as well, and Birmingham. There's, you know, as Pete mentioned, Cali's got a clown to call itself football capital of Colombia, because between them, América de Cali and Deportivo Cali have won more championships than the rest of the clubs in the country. Than any other city in the country. So, you know, this isn't only a big rivalry, it's a rivalry between two big clubs as well. And I was sort of doing a bit of research today, and for a while they played at the same stadium, although Deportivo moved to their own stadium now. But, I mean, there must have been some pulsating derbies there, a bit like the Milan derby, where, you know, they play at the San Siro, you know, Inter at home, or AC Milan at home. It's still the same ground. So, the rivalry between these two clubs, I think, is going to be a major feature of this episode.
It's, I guess, Stephen, it's, you know, we look at the cities, and, you know, certainly some of the cities that we've already been to and some yet to come. But when you think of major footballing cities in South America, it's Buenos Aires, it's Rio, Montevideo. And yet, you know, I know we've only just sort of really started in this episode, but certainly by the way Pete sort of set this up, you know, it seems like this city here, I think Pete called it the sports capital of Colombia. This is another city that, in theory, could and should be mentioned in the same breath.
Yes, you know, it is the citadel of Colombian, you know, football and power, sports and power, really. You know, most nations have a sporting hotbed of some description, and this is undoubtedly Colombia's. When we spoke of Bogota not so long ago, I think, stuck my head above the parapet and questioned whether Bogota was really a footballing city as such. You know, you cannot level that at Cali at all. You know, to have, you know, two teams in one city to have made Copa Libertadores finals, you know, to accumulate all those titles, have a rich history. And also have the double-sided coin there is that one of the sides is relatively nouveau-riche in a way, compared to the other. You know, it has every facet, every building block to, you know, a true kind of passionate hotbed of football.
I mean, I guess then, Pete, you know, we've sort of, you know, you've given us this overview of the club scene, if you like, in Cali. But and you mentioned a little bit about Atletico Cali and their sort of almost social responsibility, if you like, or social conscience. But in terms of the two big clubs then, is anything in terms of politics that, you know, who they represent? You know, you talked about the red half and the green half. Is there any sort of distinct social sort of choice between who supports which team?
Yeah, I think if you were to talk back in the origins, like in the earlier days, I think a lot of the football clubs in South America often have identities that originate from the founding eras. And then I think that a lot of loyalties tend to get passed down from father to son and so on. And then it kind of, that kind of original identity about maybe politics or maybe a particular social class starts to kind of get lost, as it tends to be a little bit more about the glory or the success, or, you know, as the kind of the years go on, those original identity factors are lost. I think that's a little bit different in Argentina, where there's a strong barrio tradition. In the case of the two clubs we're talking about, Deportivo Cali, if anything, have slightly more of a middle class, upper class kind of reputation. They're one of the earlier teams in Cali. Again, the pre-professional era in Colombia is very difficult to really pin down, in that there's very little organisational structure, and a lot of clubs will start and will kind of metamorphose. They'll kind of go out of existence as the original players, you know, get old and disappear. For example, the original Cali football team that Deportivo traced their roots back to was formed more or less in 1908 by the Lalinde brothers, who had studied in Europe. And again, you know, for Cali, which wasn't a particularly major city at the time, it's really kind of in the next few decades that Cali really starts to boom. If you're travelling to Europe to study, then you've got to be pretty well off. So we've got an idea of where the roots of that particular club are. Again, the Club Deportivo Cali in the professional era starts having a link with the Lebanese community, which was, there's quite a lot of Middle Eastern people who emigrated to Colombia. A surprising amount, actually. You wouldn't think there, but there's quite a lot of major families. Actually, Junior de Barranquilla, the major club on the Caribbean coast, is owned by Alejandro Char, which, again, he will point to Middle Eastern roots, his particular family. Cali were owned for a long time. One of the directors was a guy called Alex Gorayeb, who is a really important figure for the club. He's also very well known for refusing money from the Rodriguez Orejuela brothers, the leaders of the Cali cartel, who eventually would invest money in America and lead to America's success. One of the reasons why that is supposed to happen is that, or was supposed to happen, is that there's a little bit of snobbery in Colombia. There's a little bit of hierarchy, very kind of determined or very kind of class conscious kind of society. And with this kind of drug money that the Rodriguez Orejuela brothers were accumulating, they had this front of a pharmacy called Drogas La Rebaja, which was their legitimate front, and various other companies. The Gorayebs and various others were very suspicious of that and didn't really want to let these kind of parvenu people into their particular club. So there's always been a little bit of that kind of slightly upper class or middle class idea about Deportivo Cali. America are more of the working class club. They're called La Pasión del Pueblo. That's their kind of moniker, the passion of the people. Much more associated with working class of Cali. Stronger links a lot with a lot of the Afro-Colombian communities. If you look at one of their earliest photos from around about 1927, I think, you will actually see quite a few black players in that team photo, which is a little bit unusual. But then somehow race hasn't been quite as much of an issue in Colombian football as it has been, for example, in Brazilian football in the 1910s, 1920s, certainly in Uruguay and Chile particularly. Again, so America de Cali don't have as much financial backing. It's very noticeable that the foreigners they bring to the club in the El Dorado period aren't as successful, aren't as well known as those that Deportivo Cali bring, or Millonarios, for example. And it's only really until the 1970s and 80s where this kind of smaller club with a very strong popular backing actually gets the financial investment, illicitly as it turned out, from the Rodriguez Orejuela brothers to become such a successful club. It's worth just knowing that Boca Juniors were actually seen as the original working class club. You know, they had that kind of the name as well, you know, the name they picked. And again, they were a club that had been founded in 1937. Boca Juniors, obviously a very evocative name. There's no river mouth, though, in Cali. So, you know, it was completely ridiculous. It's purely emulating the Argentinian club. But they were the original working class club. And actually, for a long time, were actually the more successful of the Cali clubs at that particular time as well. But again, you know, I think that nowadays you wouldn't really be able to draw the kind of class lines of the supporters of the clubs. Those things have kind of merged with time, and you know, it's really kind of more to do with, I think, family loyalties and, you know, a little bit of who you quite watching playing, I think, nowadays.
We also need to think about whether or not they have a sash, because that's gonna have a massive impact on Steve later on.
I've checked.
I thought you were checked.
I'm not going to come to it yet, but I have checked.
The sash kit designers in South America are working overtime at the moment. Everyone's demanding one. Gary, listening to what Pete was saying there, and it sort of struck me that although we, you know, and Peter maybe not so much now, but certainly, you know, sort of in the early days, this sort of class diversion depending on which team you supported, and it seems strange, but it's almost like football has the power to unite classes, but yet it's also quite distinct. So depending on who you support, well, maybe based on your social class, and yet they unite over the exact same entity.
Yeah, I guess so. And if we learn one thing, we've learned lots of things in this series, but one of the things is that the importance of the barrio to a club, and how important, you know, that the where the club is located, and how it's seen to be part of of that neighbourhood, that area, rather than necessarily the city or a class. And it just so happens, I suppose, that, you know, certain clubs are based in working class areas, as it were. And it's interesting, you know, Pete, say about, you know, the drug money in. I mean, this is almost like the curse of Colombian football. It's bane and it's boost as well. You know, the success of Colombian football has been fueled by drug money, and it's also been the thing that's brought it to its knees as well. And it's interesting, you know, that I was researching a little earlier there, you know, about the Orihela brothers that funded America in the early 80s, and how it funded their success. And you almost think that, you know, it's almost like a drug. It is a drug. It's drug money, but it's a drug that's going to hurt you in the end. You know, it becomes an addiction, and you know, you get that boost, but there's an awful lot of come down in the end. And it, you know, this sort of thing just it sort of passes over class divides. And you know, interesting Pete said about, you know, Deportivo Cali were resistant to the influx of this sort of money, but as long as one club's prepared to take the money and you know, and to fuel its success, it's going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not quite sure how to work. I've not quite worked out how to ask your question yet, Steve. So you're gonna have to bear with me while I try and formulate.
Okay.
But you know, and again, it's something that we've sort of that has come through this thread, and when we did the South America files as well. And you know, Pete's great at explaining it, and it's usually the one question that I'm usually the most interested about is this social class and structure and how football plays its part in that. But I suppose what I'm trying to ask is it, and I don't expect you to know the answer, so don't worry, is it or would it difficult to support a club that is not from, that is not necessarily associated with your social class? And if you did, do you think there would be a feeling of alienation in being in and around it? I know it's a hypothetical question, but I'm just interested in what you think.
I'd say yes, certainly personally. Can't speak for everyone else, but personally, yes. You know, every football club has a soul. Every football club has an aura about them. And, you know, I think you find that most people are drawn to a specific type of football club. So whenever kind of like people will look through, because most people, well, you know, you have the team that you support, but then, you know, each league, there'll be a team that you look out for the result for, you know, that you are particularly drawn by. And if you draw the roadmap of that, I'd be surprised if they kind of like go from one extreme to the other in the political leanings or, you know, the social history of the club. You know, I would say that they probably strike a theme. And so, yes, you know, if I'm dropped into a city to work and live, then, you know, I'm going to be drawn towards a club that, you know, somehow kind of like feels like it represents me, because and football is tribal at the end of the day. And you've got to be drawn and attracted to tribes that strike some kind of common theme to you personally.
It's a great point. And now it's something else that I've just thought that I can ask Pete. So when you were there, Pete, as a 12-year-old, I mean, obviously picking which club to support, I mean, did school friends influence it? Did your dad influence it? I mean, how as a 12-year-old, and no offence to Southampton, I hope we have lots of Southampton fans listening, but I imagine it's quite different. Sort of going, the intensity of who you support as a 12-year-old sort of Englishman in a new continent, let alone a new country. How did you go about the choosing of a side?
Yeah, it's a really difficult question. I think that certainly the easiest thing to say is that my dad certainly had no influence at all. No, very little interest or knowledge in football. I mean, he's Scottish, so maybe that explains why. Sorry, Dad. I think originally, you know, I had a look at the first TV programme. You know, there was a kind of, you know, the typical match the day type thing. And there was a little bit of kit. There was a little bit of kit interest. And I think that I remember that my friends at school, you know, obviously, who do you support? You know, what team do you like? And they obviously said Southampton. And they said, oh, who are you going to support here? And the first club that had kind of resonated, slightly because I quite like the kit and slightly because it was a quite a nice name, was just a team called Sporting, who were up in the Caribbean coast. And that provoked a huge amount of laughter because they were rubbish. And actually, they didn't exist for very long either. So there was a kind of an interest in not supporting a big club. You know, that was always kind of the way I went about things. But actually, I remember that a friend of mine called Lucho, Luis Gabriel Blanco, is now a very successful musician in Cali, actually, in the salsa bands, which is salsa is like a really big deal in the city. He took me along to watch America. And that was it. This was kind of before a lot of the barras had become organized to become really massive things that had links with rather dubious organizations. And I'll come back to this in terms of tribes and stuff that Steve was talking about. But there were a lot of groups that were starting to organize, and they had names like the Seventh Star, because at the time, you know, America had only won 7 or 8, leagues. And the Red Devils, and so on. And Lucho had friends that were part of this group, so I went with him. And that was it, really. You know how it is. You go to the first game. There were a lot of good players that America had at this particular time, the likes of Anthony de Avila, Alex Escobar, centre-back called Jorge Balbis, who was someone I thought was a really good player. And that was kind of it. But yeah, so I mean, and actually at that point, it felt quite safe to go. I think things changed a lot. But I want to come back to the question you asked Steve, actually, because there's something quite interesting about tribes there. And I think that one of the things that makes being a football fan in somewhere like Colombia difficult is there's a couple of issues. Firstly, that there's been a lot of migration. So there's been a lot of migration from other parts of the country into the main cities due to the violence. I mean, there's a port city called Buenaventura, which suffers horrific violence due to the control of the drug trade. A lot of people move from there and from other parts of the Cauca into the city. So that creates very unstable communities, but it also creates communities that are looking to establish some kind of linkages, you know, as migrants within a city. And then the second thing is that there are also kind of quite defined neighborhoods, and there are existing kind of crime groups that have been quite a lot of gang type culture. That's more infamous in Medellin, but it does exist in Bogota and Cali to some extent as well. So I think what you then have is that you have very, very kind of precarious neighborhoods. You've got neighborhoods which see a lot of migration. You have neighborhoods where there is gang culture. And when you add football into that, that becomes another difficult identity thing. And crossing certain boundaries into territories that may be particularly linked to a particular group or a particular crime gang, or maybe even a really organized barra, you know, the organized fan club. Because these barras are very organized now, and they have kind of chapters in maybe certain different parts of cities. But that does create a kind of precarious, potentially dangerous environment. And you do have, you know, you do have stories of fans meeting each other in certain parts of the city and coming to blows or coming to knives or coming to even worse than that. So I think that it is a problem. It can be a safety issue. I don't think it's as bad as it potentially used to be. You know, Cali and Medellin, a city in Bogota, are cities that have improved a lot in that way. But that kind of potential tribal identity where there are very defined neighborhood links that are maybe linked with other kind of pursuits, whether criminal or not, does potentially make the kind of urban football scape, particularly in some of the poorer areas, you know, rather dangerous at times.
Brilliant. It's so interesting. Okay, in terms of the clubs, Gary mentioned earlier that, you know, the two main clubs in Cali, Pete, have probably more successful than the rest of the clubs put together in the country of Colombia. But in terms of context then, the continental success that both have taken, and then obviously domestic success where it becomes one over the other, where do they both stand?
This is me, sorry. I think that the Deportivo Cali are kind of more established. You know, they kind of are the club that really makes an impact first. And that starts on a national level, you know, at the first time of the professional era. They are They kind of have the original success for Cali. You know, that in the second year of the professional league, they come second. They hire or they buy a lot of Peruvian players. They have a team that, or a kind of forward line that become known as the Black Steamroller. And that's kind of where it starts. We have this great lineup of Valeriano Lopez, who I've talked about before, the tank of Casma, one of three players in South America to have scored more goals than matches played. He scored 23 goals in 12 games in one particular run. Was quite profligate in other ways off the pitch, however, was known to light cigars with dollar bills and so on. And then there was Luis del Tigrillo, the little tiger Salazar, and Manuel Drago. It was a really great generation. And then Boca Juniors at the time actually almost take over. They're runners-up on a couple of occasions. They come third. They have a group of Paraguayan players. And actually, they scored 110 or 115 goals in 1951. So they become, you know, the spectacle, this exciting team, whereas America aren't really doing very well. But it's quite strange that Cali doesn't win. You know, Cali as a city doesn't win until the 60s. And this is where we really see Deportivo Cali establish itself as the powerhouse of not just Cali football, but arguably taking over, or at least competing with Millonarios and Bogotá as being the dominant force. And they have a great generation winning, you know, various titles between 1965 and 1974, coming second on a few occasions as well. Again, so it is very much a domestic thing. You know, I think that at this particular time, there is very little expectation in Colombia of having international success, partly because the Copa Libertadores doesn't start till 1960 or 1961, but also for the realization that Colombia just isn't on that level. You know, they have to bring footballers in from abroad to bolster their clubs to bring quality in. And they just don't think they can compete with the Brazilian, the Uruguayan, and the Argentinian clubs at all. But when Deportivo Cali, because it is Deportivo Cali, become the first Colombian club to do that, you know, to beat Independiente, to eventually get to the Copa Libertadores semifinals and then the final, you know, that they're the club that first gets that kind of kudos as being breaking new ground. America, the Cali, take over that mantle in the 80s and become, you know, the really not only a domestic dominant force, but also a continental force. And there's a huge amount of kudos in becoming that first Colombian team to win South America. America are desperate to do it and fail. And it's actually Atlético Nacional who do that. So I think that a lot of the kind of the rivalry and the hierarchy between the two clubs for a long time is based on, you know, who's won titles. America don't for a long time, you know, until 1979, don't win a title. You know, Cali manage it, you know, 14 or 15 years previously. But then after those titles start to be won, then it becomes something more. It has to be, you have to get that continental trophy to establish yourself as being, you know, the better club, the more successful club, the more prestigious club. And with America's kind of, you know, illegal owners, if you like, the Rodriguez Orejuela brothers, who are very, very, you know, that kind of prestige is really important to them. That kind of continental dominance is really important to them. That kind of charges the domestic rivalry even more.
Before I come to the other two guys, I keep going back to Pete, and I'm really sorry, but I am really interested. Did you get to any Copa Libertadores games while you were? No,
I think it was really, that was a little bit dodgier.
Okay.
I was trying to remember this morning when the first game I went to. I mean, it wasn't a massive game. I think it was someone like Pereira. I mean, I didn't go very, we went quite a bit in the first year, but actually from the second year onwards, it became a little bit more dangerous just around, there were quite a lot of kidnappings, and actually there was certainly a teacher in the school I was going to was kidnapped, and a couple of wealthy parents of other students who were kidnapped as well. So it wasn't, you know, as a kind of family, we didn't do a huge amount of driving in and around those kind of places, just because I kind of grew quite quickly. So someone who's about 6'2", 6'3", stood out a little bit in Cali at that time. So we didn't, I think I only went to about six or seven matches, and that was mostly in the first year and a half I was there, I think.
Okay. Well, it's good for us that you didn't go, I guess. Otherwise, we wouldn't have you, and that would be a nightmare. This would be a really short series with little mini micro episodes. Gary, it's interesting what, it's all interesting, but what Pete was saying there about, and again, you know, we've looked at it through the Political Football podcast series, but how, I suppose, on a smaller scale, domestic clubs look to exert their reputation nationally and then continentally, you know, and sort of, you know, whether it's to put their city on the map, put their, you know, it's not just the football club, but it can be their city, then they go on, they're representing Colombia. And, you know, and it's that sort of desire for success that obviously comes with trophies and medals, but also that desire is, you know, as people said, about who's going to be the first club to do it, or who's going to be the first club to get to the final, who's going to be the first club to win it. And it's the prestige that comes with. And again, I guess football is probably brings more prestige than any, or can bring more prestige than any other sport to a team.
Yeah, I just worth mentioning that when I was at the age Pete mentioned earlier, and I was going to watch Warsaw play at Pillars Park, there was never much chance of getting kidnapped and for wealthy parents, because nobody will send their kids to watch Warsaw. but yeah, you're absolutely right, and you know, between these two clubs, America and Deportivo, they've got to six Copa Libertadores finals and lost them all. Deportivo got there in 65 and 78, and then when America had got their funding, shall we say, I mean, they won five titles in the bounce in the early 80s, and then they got to the Copa Libertadores finals in 85, 86, 87, and then 96, and again lost them all. And you know, I mean, the prestige that Pete mentioned that Atlético Nacional got becoming the first Colombian club to win the Copa Libertadores. It's a yearning sort of thing. It's almost like an authentication, a status, something that demands recognition and appreciation that you have arrived. You are a major club, and it's something that, you know, these two clubs, you know, despite their domestic success, are still awaiting.
It's, and I guess, Stephen, it's, you know, I suppose it's the same. Same for players, and it, you know, I don't know how many Colombian fans will have listened to this, but we might have some. but it's also an opportunity for players. You know, if you do well in the Copa Libertadores, you then become well known in Europe, which can then get you the move to Europe. And so there's that. I guess what starts off as being a very localized sort of prestige that, you know, that being the first club in the city to do it, then, you know, you're the first club in Colombia to do it. But actually, as a player, you know, you can also use it as the ultimate shop window. And especially now with how global the game is, you know, we watch, you know, we've all got access to the Copa Libertadores now. Most we've got access to the Copa Libertadores if we've got it on the satellite, but although, you know, if they're showing it on terrestrial television. But it's not only prestige for the area, it can have a converse effect, whereby it can also be the beginnings of the falling apart or the dismantling of a side as well.
Yeah, and that's something that's crept into European football as well now. You don't have to look at kind of like Ajax reaching the Europa League final and into the semi-finals within seconds of the 2019 Champions League final. You know, and then suddenly all these other teams swoop for these wonderful players. So it tends to be an eye of the needle, eye of the storm kind of moment for these clubs to step forward and have this bright flash of brilliance. And then the kind of, you know, that magical moment is over and they have to rebuild again. But then they're richly rewarded for the, you know, the player that they sell on, whether that's to, you know, other teams in South America, in the more traditional, you know, the biggest football playing nations across the continent. Or straight to Europe, you know, it is the ultimate shop window for South American players.
I just want to come back to something that you mentioned. Well, actually, Gary mentioned it about the suspicious funding, shall we call it, for certain teams. Has there ever been? Because I guess it's how you prove it. So I'm pretty sure that's going to be your answer, but if it's one of those everybody knows but nobody says anything, is there ever call to have any trophies or leagues that are won invalidated because of where the funding has come from? Does it ever get to that stage, or is it just an accepted consequence of football clubs in South America or in Colombia?
Yeah, I think that it's never been seriously contemplated. But I think there was a general impression that almost all of the league was somehow tarnished by it. One of the things that Deportivo Cali actually have in its favour is that they've never had associations with it. This is one of the things that Alex Goriab is kind of held in huge esteem and kind of as Deportivo Cali fans will say, he was the man that stood up to drug money. I think there was some talk about Millonarios at one point wanting to, or potentially renouncing one of their titles due to their particular owner, who was a guy called Gacha Rodriguez, who was known as the Mexican for his love of kind of Mexican sombreros and so on. But it's kind of, it's never really seriously contemplated. I mean, I think that unfortunately there is such kind of just an acceptance that drug money was there, and almost that, you know, as most of the big clubs are in it anyway, it almost leveled itself out. You know, I mean, Atlético Nacional, América, Millonarios, Santa Fe, you know, some of the smaller clubs like Unión Magdalena, I think Pereira had slightly dubious owners as well. So in some ways, I don't think that those trophies will ever be re-awarded, you know, because you can't really, you know, because who would you give it to? Oh, we could give it to, they came second, but they had links with, you know, Fano or Isabaleta or whoever it might have been. I think that, you know, that, I mean, certainly it's a huge stain on that particular era. And I think really, you know, there were two points where, there was a point where it could have been dealt with in 1983, when the Justice Minister, Lara Bonilla, said publicly, you know, that the Colombian football had been taken over by the mafia. But Di Mayor, the Colombian Professional Football League, who had several directors were on the kind of governing body at the time, didn't act at all. So there was a point there where they could have dealt with it. But I mean, it's probably they didn't, because this was like the second boom of popularity of Colombian football. We see, you know, fans return the stadiums, big name players, instead of the kind of the journeyman Paraguayan, the journeyman Brazilian, the journeyman Argentinian who'd been coming along to leagues, you know, doing pretty well, sometimes nationalising and ending up playing for the Colombian team. We suddenly have proper footballers coming, you know, some of the people who are, you know, playing for Paraguay, playing for Argentina, playing for, you know, some Peru, the best clubs in the continent. The second time where they really almost, you know, they do put a slight stop to is 1989, where Alvaro Ortega, the referee, gets murdered. And Alex Goriab, again, we come back to Alex Goriab as one of the kind of the most, you know, the most distinguished figure in Colombian football, who is in charge of Di Mayor at the time, cancels the league. You know, 1989, no one wins the league at all. But that's as close as it gets to some kind of admittance that, you know, things are wrong, things need to change, things need to be deleted from the history. It's a very sad side of Colombian football that hasn't really been, I don't think it can be whitewashed. I don't think they can readdress those, you know, the league titles that were won then, because it's, you know, I don't see how you award, you know, trophies after that.
It's funny. I'm going to ask Gary that question. I mean, you know, obviously, going off topic a little bit, but obviously, when you look at someone like Lance Armstrong, and there's, you know, there's seven non-winners of the Tour de France in a row. There's, you know, there's just a gap where his name was. Obviously, in this sort of a situation, it's a lot more difficult to prove. It, you know, Lance Armstrong is one man winning one race, whereas this is a collective, you know, going about, Peter, trying to pick it apart, trying to prove that other clubs don't have this, any of this sort of influence. But in an ideal world, where do you stand on this, Gary? Would you like to see, I'm not saying Colombia shouldn't whitewash their league titles, I'm not saying that, but in terms of trophies that are won with dubious money, shall we say, you know, would you like to see them removed?
It's interesting way you phrase the question here. Where do you stand? I think the answer is, if you make any kind of bold statement, the answer is on shaky ground. Because You know, how clean is clean? How dirty is dirty? How corrupt is corruption? You know, we could say the all money in Manchester City and PSG, is that wonderful? You know, the Russian money at Chelsea, is that wonderful? The hedge fund money that's American supporting enterprises that Man United and Liverpool, how clean is that? The answer is nothing is clean in big football. And, you know, I mean, you know, there's degrees of not nice. But once you start saying, well, the thing with Lance Armstrong is it's like different in as much as performance enhancing drugs. So it was a clear cheating situation. It wasn't drugs in Colombian, well, it was drugs, but it wasn't drugged players, shall we say, in Colombian football. So I think you're on really shaky ground once you start saying, well, that is sufficiently bad to make you disqualified. You had this, the almost repeated episodes in Syria, but there again, that was sort of match fixing. That was corruption rather than clubs being owned by people who are somewhat less than squeaky clean. And I suppose if you only allowed clubs to be compete in tournaments or to be awarded the trophies as the highest non-winner, shall we say, when somebody else is less than squeaky clean, you're going to go a long way down to find the the person to award the trophy. As Pete says, if you pick off the big drug money, then you're down to the small drug money, and then you're down to perhaps other less savoury owners. It's so where do I stand? If you make a bold claim on that, the answer is on really shaky ground.
Nicely answered, Gary. Well done. And hence why I asked you that question.
Thank you, buddy.
That's all right. I guess, Pete, you know, obviously, we've talked about these two clubs. And obviously, the last episode we did, it was, you know, we were in Buenos Aires and you guys had to pick between River Plate and Boca Juniors. Here, I'm not saying it's any less difficult, but is this a case of it of sort of ebb and flow? And, you know, at some point, America de Cali are the bigger club, and another point is, you know, Deportivo Cali, or is there a... You know, is there a common consensus as to which is the biggest club?
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things about this particular rivalry is that it's hard to find a time where they're both really, really good at the same time, where they're almost fighting for the league trophy together. That's one of the things that I think if we're looking at the most important, passionate and rivalries that really meant something, that when you know that they're always there in the final, they're always there winning the leagues, they're always there. You know, the Cali Derby actually isn't really like that. You know, there's quite defined periods where the two clubs are successful and the other one isn't. You know, I mean, I mentioned earlier that Deportivo Cali are a really big, really important team in the right at the start of the El Dorado League, but actually Boca Juniors are the other main team at that point. America de Cali, you know, I think they come fifth. That's about the best they do in the first kind of, you know, 5 or 6 years when it matters. Boca Juniors and Deportivo were the bigger two teams. Deportivo Cali are dominant in the 60s and 70s. America de Cali still aren't. You know, they're starting to sign a few players. But then as America de Cali do well, as the money starts to furrow in and as they make, you know, really important signings of Battaglia and Falcioni and Gareca and, you know, some of the Peruvians and great players of that particular era. America de Cali are right up there, and Cali kind of fall down. You know, they don't have the same influx of money. They start on a slightly different model of, you know, of trying to develop more Colombian players potentially. Deportivo Cali do have a kind of a potential period where Valderrama, Valderrama's probably in Colombian terms at his best at Deportivo Cali when he's playing in tandem with a guy called Bernardo Redin, a much kind of underrated Colombian midfielder who was a bit David Platt-like and scoring, you know, important goals for Colombia in the 1990 World Cup. But they never really push America de Cali for the title. That's really up to Atlético Nacional and Millonarios at the time. Then, you know, you kind of have a period where Deportivo Cali start returning to some success in the 90s, but then this is when America is starting on their downward trend. You know, America de Cali are on the Clinton list. you know, their financial income is severely limited due to their links with drug cartels. So sponsorship is dying off. Their financial income is dying. So again, the rivalry loses that kind of luster in terms of being extremely competitive in the league anyway. America de Cali then have a period, you know, out of the top division. So it's a kind of funny one. There are very defined periods where either team are the dominant force in the city, but it's hard to pick a time where they're both really competing for the league title at the same time, and where, you know, where they have that great final where the winner of the match will win the league. And it's you know, and it's either Cali or it's America. That hasn't really happened.
I mean, Stephen, it's funny that as Pete was chatting there, I was trying to sort of come up with some sort of contextualization, and the nearest I got was the sort of early mid-80s with Liverpool and Everton for sort of four or five seasons when they go at it against each other. But it is very rare that two teams from the same city over a prolonged period of time are going at it, as it were.
Yes, as Pete describes, there is usually some kind of baton being passed between one and the other. You know, these spikes in endeavour to be simultaneous is very, very rare. It's hugely rare. Yes, Liverpool and Everton in the mid-1980s is the only one I've personally experienced in reach out and touch terms. And yes, you know, America and Deportivo here, they lean towards that other side of that, something like Arsenal and Tottenham in a way. You know, one rises, the other one ebbs for a little bit, and they never kind of like fall to dramatic, you know, kind of like levels. They just fade off a bit, and they regroup and then come again, by which time the other one starts to fade away. You know, hence you have Tottenham winning the double in 60-61 and then Arsenal doing it 10 years later. You know, you have a compelling Tottenham side at the beginning of the 1980s when Arsenal can't win anything, you know, after they've just ended the 70s, you know, relatively brightly, three successive FA Cup finals. So there is that defined kind of like pass of the baton, you know, and this is what happens with the two here that we're speaking of. And yes, you know, for the two. But it is interesting in the way that they kind of go toe-to-toe, but in not in tandem, in relay. You know, they both reach those Copa Libertadores finals. They both collect national titles. And it's almost like, you know, a mirror image is what you're seeing of each team.
I'm really sorry, Gary, but here's your question. Why is this? Why don't... Because it's only something that's just struck me in the last couple of minutes. Why do teams from the same city, as Stephen and Pete have so eloquently discussed, struggle to sustain periods of dominance between themselves? I'm sorry.
Okay. You know those weather indicators where you've got the plastic things with the bloke with the umbrella and the woman with the sunbathing thing? When it's hot, she comes out. When it's a bit like that. It can't be hot and rainy at the same time. So one will always be successful out in the weather, and the other one will always be hiding. I mean, it's an interesting thing to ponder on. I'm not sure, is it always true? It's certainly sometimes true. For instance, Milan and Inter in Milan sort of passed the Scudetto across the curva, from the curva sud to the curva nord, a few times in relatively, in succession, but in relatively short terms. I don't know. It's a really interesting thing to ponder. I don't know. I mean, success in football. I mean, you know, if I say this quite often about, you know, when we're just having podcasts about teams and clubs and success, nothing's forever in football, but short term things are. So you will get periods of dominance for perhaps 3 or 4 years, and then somebody else will take over. And I guess when you're talking about places like Colombia, there aren't 10 clubs who are going to be successful. Perhaps 4 or 5 who are going to be competing potentially for the title. If one has a period of success, then sort of fades away, to use Stevie's term, then another one will come to the fore. I don't know. It's a really good question, Stu, actually. I'm going to go away and study it, and I'll get back to you next week.
It is. While you were chatting, I just thought of Celtic and Rangers, which kind of...
Well, I mean, that's, I guess you could say... I mean, you could say Barcelona and Real Madrid, they're not from the same city, but, you know, that sort of...
Yeah, but you know, I mean, even Celtic and Rangers, you look through their histories, there tends to be one that is the predominant one.
Nine in a row.
And then the other one wins nine in a row. Then, you know, the other one wins nine in a row. So it does still, you know, to go toe-to-toe in the middle of the ring, you know, if we're talking in kind of like terms of Hearns and Hagler,
yeah.
Then you know, that just doesn't tend to happen in football. You know, great shout from Gary about Milan. That's, you know, as close as we come, I think. Yeah. You know, there's but even then there's various eras, you know, Inter, you look how they kind of like didn't win Serie A kind of like very often between 19, you know, they won it in 1980, they won in 89, but until Mancini kind of like in the mid-2000s, you know, they kind of like ebbed away. They weren't really challenging when Sarri was winning the title. You know, that kind of 88, 89 handing over was a rarity. You know, that wasn't the rule. That was the exception. So, yes, you know, it's always... football's never ending, though, isn't it? It's the perpetual motion marathon. You know, there is no finish line. It continues to go off and off and off onto the horizon. And a bit like when you've got kind of like a bike race where kind of like there'll be someone who'll hit the front and then ease back a bit and let three or four go past them before striking again. You know, that's the way football tends to work.
The only one I can think of is Roma and Lazio exchanged titles in successive years, didn't they?
But even then, I think
it's really unusual, isn't it?
I don't think they've won half a dozen titles
over
the course of all that time. You know, you do have cities where there are huge clubs that share the same environment, but to have two clubs so omnipresent to share that environment, but also be punching the weight simultaneously, is still a massively rare thing.
Yeah, there was a thing wasn't Liverpool and Everton. Was sort of first and second, sort of like out of 10 years or something, weren't they? The 70s and early 80s?
Liverpool and Everton, I mean, the most time, again, they've kind of like swapped and changed. There was a period in the mid-1960s where, you know, Everton won the title in 63, Liverpool won it 65, but then the 60s were wide open. We've spoken about that before. Eight different league champions and stuff like that. You know, Everton were, you know, drifted off in the 70s after winning the title in 1970, but then it's that little period of time in the mid-1980s where, you know, Everton rise again and Liverpool remain, you know, relevant. You know, Liverpool won the title 84, Everton 85, Liverpool 86, Everton 87, Liverpool 88. So, you know, there is that period of time there, you know, but there's nothing else like it in English football as far as next-door neighbours disputing the trophies.
You know what I'm going to say? There's a book in this, guys.
Well, see, this is why I like just asking the questions, because listening to you guys chat, and then I just think, well, I wonder why that is.
There's a book in this.
I mean, it's more common in South America, but that's basically because the capital city is so much of a dominant force. And again, you have the thing that, you know, one team in Buenos Aires or Asunción or Montevideo or either Sao Paulo or Rio will do well, and you know what it's like, you know, the vultures of European scouts will come calling, will take the vital players. And again, I think in South America now, the turnaround is shorter because, you know, the players that are leaving are really 20, 21, 22. So actually the next crop of youngsters is only 2 or 3 years away. In Colombia, it wasn't quite like that, possibly. You know, you didn't really have that cherry picking of talents coming and going. So maybe that's why the clubs are having a longer period of success. I think that, I guess what you do have, I was trying to think why it might be, and I guess that, you know, when a club, you know, like Deportivo Cali or America start in with a period of success and it lasts longer, you know, they start to ebb when those successful players start leaving. In the America de Cali, when Falcioni, when Battaglia, when, you know, when Gareca retired, there was a slight drop off. And again, that's given the other club a chance to build a model that can defeat it, you know, build a youth process, work out how to train, work out how to create a slight, you know, a slightly more concrete system that might lead to a successful challenge. So I think that's possibly maybe why in Colombia you have these slightly more longer ebbs and flows, and that might well be the case in Ecuador and Peru as well, where there isn't quite that same, you know, year on year kind of disappearance and influx of you young players.
It's certainly an interesting point to consider. Anyway, back to where we were. The last sort of point then, Pete, you know, you've sort of touched on names, but in terms of, you know, names that I guess these two clubs have produced, or certainly that have come from Cali, coaches, you know, who are the sort of standout names through history?
Yeah, I think I talked a little bit about the first Deportivo Cali great side, you know, the black steamroller of Valerian La Lopez and Manuel Drago. That certainly is one of the great teams. In terms of the generation of the 60s and 70s, again, no one is really kind of world famous. You know, they're famous in Cali, but a lot of the guys that do well are journeyman players, mostly strikers that come from Brazil, come from Argentina, and find a home and find somewhere that they can be world class, or, you know, or Colombian class. Iroldo Rodriguez from Brazil is one of the first to do that at Deportivo Cali in the 60s side. He's followed by a guy called Alberto El Tigre Benitez, who was a kind of a rock star kind of centre forward, scored something like 136 goals for Deportivo Cali, a really charismatic Argentinian striker. Again, then you have, well, Miguel Escobar was a real stalwart of the defence. There's a guy called Jairo Arboleda, who is the first kind of number 10 from Colombia, who seems to have that flair. Very mercurial, very talented, very skillful, never quite makes it on the international level. Then you have Valderrama and Rodin, who we've mentioned. After that, you know, since then, you've really got players who start their career at Deportivo Cali. And there's a few names that people will be familiar with. Mario Yepes, the captain of the Colombia 2014 team, started in Cali. He was a member of the team that got to the Copa Libertadores again, lost against Palmeiras, then had a very successful career in Europe. We could talk about Hamilton Rickard, Hugo Rodallega, were players who, you know, had successful careers in the Premier League, both started their career at Deportivo Cali. In terms of managers of Cali, some very famous names. Carlos Bilardo, the great Argentinian manager, had a couple of spells at Deportivo Cali, as did the master of anti-football, Osvaldo Zubeldia. He actually died in Colombia, but he was bought as Colombia searched for managers that would transform talented players to become successful on a continental level. In terms of America de Cali, most of their great figures really appear in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Some of the kind of figures I've mentioned, or, you know, I've mentioned a few, like Falcioni, the great Argentine goalkeeper. There are a couple of very talented Brazilians, Guillermo La Rosa, Cesar Cueto. In terms of my favourite players, though, the generation when I was there, the likes of Freddy Rincon, who scored one of the most iconic goals for Colombia in the 1990 World Cup in the last seconds against West Germany, slipping the ball through Bodo Ilunga's legs for a nutmeg goal. He was a real hero of the club at the time. Alex Escobar was an extremely talented, creative midfielder who never quite got a game in Colombia because there was a bloke called Valderrama who played ahead of him. One of the very good centre-backs, Jorge Bermudez, who had a really successful career in Argentina, was another kind of really important figure. But again, a lot of the players, I suppose, nowadays, you know, they don't establish their legendary status at the club anymore. You know, they start as young players, but then they're gone. You know, they're gone and they're playing in Argentina or Mexico or even, you know, somewhere like Belgium, or, you know, there's a lot of young players at Belgium at the moment, for example, who will then hopefully transfer to the new level. One figure that's worth mentioning, who is a bit of a character at Deportivo Cali, is a guy called Gerardo Bedoya, who is not particularly well known unless you're a fan of a long-range goal against Honduras in the 2001 Copa America, which Colombia won. But if you are a fan of absolute violence on the football pitch, this guy's your man. 46 red cards, most in history. Had 14 of them at Deportivo Cali, a lot of them for brilliant two-footed lunges or fantastic arguing with anyone over anything. His assistant managerial career didn't last very long. After 22 minutes, he got sent off for arguing with the ref. So Gerardo Bedoya, it all started at Deportivo Cali. So he's another figure that we probably is worth mentioning.
Brilliant. It's funny, he was brought up in, someone brought him up on social media, on Twitter, I think, the other day. I'd never heard of him. And so I can't remember what the reason was that someone had brought him up. And I had to go and look at him to check out. Was it 46 red cards?
46, yeah.
I had to go and check it just to make sure it was true. But yeah, you are actually right. I was reading about him the other day. Okay, so questions for this one. I'm going to give you this one, Stephen. So in terms of Colombian players, you know, we look at, don't worry, Gary, you've got one as well. In terms of, you know, the Brazilians, you can sort of, I don't want to pigeonhole people because you can't, but in terms of if someone had to define a stereotypical Brazilian footballer, they could do it. Argentinian, they could do it. Uruguayan, they could probably do it. But in terms of a Colombian footballer, how would you describe the sort of stereotypical Colombian footballer? Because to me, it seems to be a little bit of a struggle, or I struggle with it, which is probably why I've asked you the question, to be fair.
I think there is a broad spectrum, really, from the hard-working, you know, kind of the pawn on the chess table, if you so wish, to, you know, the artistic flourish. You don't have to look at a player like Faustino Asprilla for someone that has some outrageous talent. But, I mean, some of the most talented Colombian players seem to have a laconic kind of, you know, aura to them as well. There is an ease with which they play. They flow and they're very fluid. I personally think that players from Colombia, a bit like some of the players from Chile, have retained that South American, traditional South American tilt to their game. Whereas kind of like some Argentinian players, some Brazilian players, have almost become a caricature or a, you know, I don't know, they almost project what a European side would want from them. Whereas I think this is something that Colombian players, the best of them, just kind of like play to their own tune almost. You know, there isn't that pressure to project this image of, you know, to sell themselves to Europe. In that respect, not in the same way that Argentinians and Brazilians do. The best way for me to go, there is a broad spectrum, but I think the skilled players just still have that, I don't know, that carefree enthusiasm almost.
Okay, good answer. Well done. I appreciate that. We'll come to Pete, who lived there. We'll ask him again. We'll ask him in a second. I'm sure your answer's dead on, Steve. Gary, for you, Carlos Valderrama, where does he sit in terms of number 10s in South America? You know, you look at, obviously there's Pelé, Maradona, Francescoli, Zico. You know, where does Valderrama sit in that sort of era, if you like, or within that position and that shirt number?
I mean, these sort of questions are all about opinion, aren't they? I'll speak for my opinion. Not very highly, I would say. You know, I mean, I could probably name half a dozen Brazilian number 10s better than him, that I would say better than him, and probably not far short of the same number of Argentines. You know, he was, don't get me wrong, I wouldn't say he was rubbish. I mean, obviously, he's a world-class player, but I don't think he was ever in the, you know, the top 10 number 10s of world football, shall we say. I think, you know, he had this appearance that made him stand out from the crowd anyway, which didn't enhance his ability, but he probably enhanced his reputation, his recognition, and that sort of thing. So Yeah, I think, you know, a more than decent player, obviously, but is he anywhere, you know, in, you know, if you say now in the top 20, Brazil, South American number 10, he might sneak into that in the lower half, but that's probably, from our point of view anyway, I mean, decent player, and perhaps in a better side, you know, if he was playing in Brazilian side or an Argentine side, he might shine better, but as I say, I would feel fairly confident naming a dozen number 10s. I mean, I'm going back in history, obviously, you know, we're talking about Pelé going back 50 years, you know. But, you know, good, but not in the top 10.
So we'll come to you now, Pete, because you've got to pick this all up. So obviously, Stephen's comments about stereotypical players, Gary just not rating Valderrama at all. No, he never said that, I'm kidding. but in terms of, you know, where he sits, I suppose, you know, two things. You know, I guess Stephen's pretty close with how he sort of defined and described Colombian footballers. But also, you know, I think Gary does make a great point about Valderrama being style, whether that's physical appearance over actual footballing substance. Is that how he's perceived in Colombia, or is he, oh, sorry, South America, is that how he's perceived?
Yeah, I mean, I think after all of us plump for Boca Juniors being the biggest club of Buenos Aires, you know, we're not going to be able to go to Colombia now either. That's kind of Gary's happily just annoyed the whole of Colombia. I think that's kind of fair enough in lots of ways. We start with Valderrama as a question. You know, he won very little. Partly that's the team he played for. You know, he played for Millonarios when they weren't that quite as good. Deportivo Cali when they weren't quite as good. You know, he went to Montpellier and Valladolid, neither contenders. I think what's so important about Valderrama is that he transforms Colombia. You know, he is Colombian, and I mean Colombian football certainly, but he becomes the icon, the symbol that Colombia needs, and that's why he's so important. You know, I think, yeah, he is a quality player. He is the metronome. He is the fulcrum. He is the hub of. He is the simplicity, the ease. But also why he matters in Colombia is he is a new symbol for Colombia. Instead of Colombia being this narco center, this place of violence and corruption and drugs and bombs and the paramilitaries and guerrillas and murder and kidnapping, Valderrama is hope. He is talent. He is proof that Colombia can be something else. He is associated with the Caribbean coastline, which is symbolic of party, of free living, of, you know, the Caribbean, of all of that involves. And that's really important for Colombia. That kind of side of Colombia became a necessary symbol of something different. And, you know, Colombia's, the way that Colombia articulates itself through football as part of its national identity at the time that I was there and for the next 4 or 5 years depends on Valderrama being part of that joyous football that is completely the antithesis of the violence and drug violence of the country. That's why he matters so much. And I think that why the Colombia's search for a style, you know, and again, why Steve was completely spot on, but it's a really big question that Colombia struggles to define its football style and a style that can be proud of. For a long time, they are defensive. They're doing things on the break. They're trying to find a way to win. They're trying to find an identity. You know, they copy, they get foreign managers to try and help them find a style. A lot of them are Argentinian. Then they go for Yugoslavs. There's a time where they actually wear this horrible kind of orange, pinkish kit to kind of be like the Dutch. But the style that they find with Valderrama's generation becomes something different. And it's kind of like an amalgam of the country's different regional characteristics as they are kind of stereotypically supposed. You have, for a starting point, the hardworking midfielder centre-backs who tend to come from Antioquia, which is the Medellin kind of part of the country. And that's associated with industry, with hard work, with honesty, with you know, a very kind of serious approach. And that's important for the Colombian team. And that's where Andres Escobar comes from. That's where Barabas Gomez comes from. That's where some of the other, Chonto Pereira is I think a Nacional player at the time. So that becomes the kind of the serious, the hardworking side that Colombia is trying to produce. But then you have the flair, you have the charisma, you have the the unpredictability, the imagination that comes from the Caribbean coast with Valderrama. It comes from the Pacific coast with the likes of, you know, the players from Cali. Cali is kind of very closely linked to the Pacific, so the Pacific coast is quite nearby. So that brings that in. And the fusion of this is the way in which Colombia tries to not only envisage its football style, but also its national style, and put that in contrast to all the negative impacts of, you know, of terrorism, of violence, of the drug trafficking. So I think that, you know, Steve's right. Colombia is a very disparate place, a very different regional parts that have very clear identities. And that team in 1990, and again in 1994, though it failed then, but then once again in 2014, was the successful merging of the supposedly imagined or real, but at least narrated, best characteristics of what Colombia had. You know, hard work, industry, you know, a certain sense of seriousness combined with flair, happiness, style, charisma. And that's really manifested in those dances, you know, the dances that, you know, Colombia scored in the 2000 World Cup. That was very much part of that stylistic identity of a country finally able to celebrate and doing so in the football pitch and being mirrored in this new wave of national optimism that football team brung in association with the ongoing peace process at the time.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Guys, we're already at an hour and 20. Obviously, Stephen, this is your favourite time now where you get to pick. So if you've moved jobs and you guys are now relocating to Cali for work. So I'm gonna drop you off there. But before I go, which team are you going to support? Obviously, sashes are optional.
Not this time, unfortunately.
Oh, no. Well, I'm going to start with you then, Stephen. So if there's no sash, sash side available...
It's not been made easy for me, this one.
No, it hasn't now.
Yeah, it's not been made easy. You know, by rights, America should be the one in playing all red. You know, Pete can show me around. You know, very relevant in the 1980s. But then on the other hand, they go and call themselves the Red Devils, which, you know, completely goes against the ethos. So there's a touch of that gif of Larry David from Curb Your Enthusiasm on one hand, and then on the other, that one going on. So, you know, that taken into account, you know, yes, Deportivo, you know, yeah, you know, there's something about them, but I don't know, I'm maybe going to go for the fly-by night at Atletico, you know, just to stay out of the row. And also, I think Atletico, it's a decent looking kit that looks a bit like Leeds RL, actually, when I come to look at it. So I do take the kits into account of all this. And within that, you know, if they do a season ticket for the same ground, if you can get a season ticket for the ground, I get three clubs for the price of one.
Well, there you go. You can't argue with that.
I can't go Boca Juniors because I can't, you know. Great history and all that, but I can't go for a club that simply calls himself after another club. I can't do that. You know, that's a bit like kind of like saying you like the bootleg Beatles more than you like the Beatles, or Beyond again more than you like ABBA. I can't do it.
Okay. Well, that was the bootleg Beatles and Beyond Again.
Bootleg Beatles, Beyond Again, all fine. Yeah, but I'm not going to like you more than I like ABBA and the Beatles.
That's fair. Maybe even they would be disappointed if you did.
They'd be amazed, I'm sure.
Gary, I'll come to you next. I can't wait for your rationale. Who are you supporting, Gary?
Well, strange enough, I'm going to be sitting next to Stevie because I'm going with Atletico as well. I mean, I didn't know a lot about them, but, you know, when Pete gave us a little bit of background and their sort of political stance, I mean, I thought, well, that drops some nice into place for me. And, you know, America and Deportivo, you know, they're both big clubs and successful, but there's something, and the kit's really, as Stevie mentioned, the kit is really nice. It's almost sort of like an inverted Sampdoria kit with the bands across the chest. And so, yeah, I think I'm going to be sharing a beer with Stevie in Sports Atletico.
I mean, I will ask you, Pete, but I guess you're just going to go back home.
I mean, it would be quite a shock if I suddenly thought, actually, America, they won the league last year. Yeah. That's it now. They've won too much. I need to go back to sporting a rubbish team up for the Caribbean coast again. I'm going to stay with America. You know, when you go there, you establish loyalties. I've got a lot of fond memories of the players there. It's great to see them coming back as a clean club and actually winning things again without the, you know, the monies that tainted so much of their career. I mean, I hope Boca Juniors do well. I really hope they come back and establish a reputation. I get what Steve's saying. But, you know, there is a tradition in South America of teams, you know, emulating and really respecting, you know, clubs. I mean, there's Everton in Chile. I mean, which better club could you ask to I mean, there is a Liverpool in Uruguay as well. I should go and say that. But so there's a kind of, I mean, it's an interesting thing why clubs name themselves. And actually, it would be a brilliant story if a club that was a great of the 50s, of a great era of Colombian football, found a way to be permanent in that Liga B, establish a fan base, find a way to, you know, develop itself again. And who knows, you know, make it back into the first division. That would be a really nice story for Colombian football, because I think Colombian football needs clubs with permanence. You know, I mean, I think poor old Stephen and Gary, you know, in 2 years' time, they might be...
Yeah, like, they won't be there, yeah.
Yeah, they've probably moved up to the Caribbean or somewhere else in the country. Yeah. But, it's America for me, so.
Brilliant. Guys, it's been, all these episodes are great. This has been no exception. It's been absolutely wonderful. Pete, just brilliant. Like I say, there definitely needs to be a spin-off, Pete Watson School Days, that goes on where we can just chat about what that was like. I wouldn't say we can compare stories, but I only moved 40 miles down the coast. It wouldn't stand up in comparison, I don't think. Gary, you enjoyed it?
Yeah, it's been brilliant. I mean, as you say, every episode we do in this series, we've done in the other sorts of Link series, the South American Falls have all been amazing. And school days, I mean, we mentioned about, you know, Pete's school days. Well, these are school days for us, mate. And, you know, I'm sure Steve would agree as well. We learned so much listening to Pete talking about the South American football. Yeah, been an absolute joy. And we're looking forward to the next one as well, where we're traveling 1,300 kilometres away from Cali to Guayaquil in Ecuador. And it's going to be great. That'll be great as well. I mean, I don't know anything about Guayaquil yet, but I will do by then. And I'll know even more after Pete sort of give us some of the details as well.
I've only got a few days to learn how to pronounce it. I'm still struggling with it and dreading that one. I might have lost my voice for that one. Stephen, enjoyed it?
Oh, magnificent as always. As Gary said, no, so much to learn, so much to enjoy about these podcasts. And yeah, absolute ball, long may they last.
Excellent. And Pete, hopefully it was enjoyable to sort of have a little reminisce and a go back to, like I said, to your school days.
Yeah, no, it was great fun to go back. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of somewhere I really am desperately keen to go back to. Next time I find a way to do any research out in Colombia, I'll be heading back to Cali and see if I can get to the Pascual Guerrero a few more times, the stadium, and watch America in action. But no, it's always a great fun, always nice chatting with you guys, and you know, seeing where we get to in the debates and cartoon references.
Yeah, we can say goodbye to the hair, although my hair appointment's not until the 4th of May, so I'll still be a member of the Hair Bear Bunch for a couple of weeks yet. Guys, like I say, it's brilliant. All that's left for me to say is thank you for listening, and please join us again next time where I can't pronounce where we're going on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.